This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Since the day it started to be adopted by the states, Common Core has been controversial. Conservatives and liberals both love it and both hate it. Still, 42 states and the District of Columbia became part of the Common Core movement.
If we raise a generation of kids who have been taught this, we're going to lose our democratic character. We're going to teach a generation of kids that their job is to follow instructions and obey and not think for themselves.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to the author of a new book that calls Common Core a threat to democracy itself. We'll also spend an academic minute celebrating the birthday of another boogeyman, Frankenstein. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. The Common Core Standards for Mathematics and English Language Arts were released on June 2, 2010. In a matter of months, well more than half the 50 states adopted the standards. But the rollout in many states was not smooth, and detractors of the standards have become louder as results from school and student assessments became available. But even with some states repealing the standards, they are still fully in force in 36 of the 50. Nicholas Tampio thinks that's 36 too many. Dr. Tampio is an associate professor of political science at Fordham University in New York. He gives a step-by-step argument against the standards in his new book, Common Core, National Education Standards and the Threat to Democracy. We spoke about the book, and I said I assumed he wrote it because he enjoyed getting into arguments.
Well, you know, like a lot of people in the Common Core fight, I'm a parent of young children, and I've just seen what it's doing in reality to our kids' educational experience. So we're familiar with the slogans of college and career readiness and internationally benchmark and prepare them for life and all these other sort of slogans. But when we actually see what the Common Core does to our education, our kids' education, it makes it worse. And so one of the reasons I wrote my book, Common Core, was to really go into the standards themselves and show that the things that parents are protesting are when the Common Core standards are being implemented faithfully. You know, my experience has been that the more you dig into the Common Core, the more suspect it is, right? So basically, this man named David Coleman, who's now known as the Common Core architect, met with Bill and Melinda Gates and said, there's been this movement and this idea in circulation for a while now about creating national education standards. I'm your man. If you fund my efforts, I will lead this effort to create the Common Core state standards. And so Bill and Melinda Gates opened up their pocketbooks and gave him $10 million, or his organization, Student Achievement Partners, and some other organizations, $10 million to write the standards. And then, according to this Washington Post article, they spent, at the time, over $200 million to other organizations to promote the Common Core. So the fact of the matter is that a lot of the key decisions were made in privacy, in a non-democratic manner, and that's part of what makes a lot of people so upset.
I want to talk to you about the democracy part because, I mean, some things, not everything can be democratic, can it?
My argument is that the Common Core standards themselves lead to an undemocratic education, and I'll explain what I mean. The first Common Core English Language Arts anchor standard requires students to cite specific textual evidence when answering a question about a text. Now, most of us can agree that there are occasions in life when you need to provide specific textual evidence. But what the Common Core requires is that students read a passage and then answer questions about that passage using the exact words in the text. They need text-dependent and text-specific answers. So really what it literally requires students to do is use the exact words in the text to get full credit for an assignment. So if they use synonyms, they won't get credit. If they think for themselves, they won't get credit. If they make connections to things in their lives or other things that they've read, they won't get credit. So what we're doing is from the time kids enter kindergarten till the time they go off to college, we're telling them you have to use other people's words. You are not allowed to speak up and share your own thoughts. And so my concern is if we raise a generation of kids who have been taught this, we're going to lose our democratic character. We're going to teach a generation of kids that their job is to follow instructions and obey and not think for themselves.
Well, you certainly can't have the same argument for math standards. I mean, the number is the number.
Well, you know, one of the pleasures of researching this book is I learned a lot. And one of the things I learned is that there's a disagreement among math educators about how to teach math. And so there's one school of thought, let's call them the behaviorists, and they say the important thing is to get the correct answer. And as long as you get the correct answer, that demonstrates sufficient proof of understanding. There's another school of thought, let's call them constructivists, who say you actually have to show your work and you actually have to define your terms to make sure that you understand what you're talking about. So this was the math wars of much of the 20th century in America. And the Common Core State Standards, they have something called the Standards of Mathematical Practice that try to get both procedural mastery and conceptual understanding. But for the behaviorists, that's still too much closer to the constructivists. It still requires students to show their work and to define their terms. And so one of the critiques is that there are a lot of children on the autism spectrum who are good at math, but who cannot define their terms or show their work. So kids who in a different educational system could be outstanding in math, under Common Core math, they're really going to suffer.
Those kids on the spectrum, they're all going to have an IEP, so that should be taken care of there.
Well, I don't know if they all have IEPs. And then you also confront the fact that a lot of kids on the autism spectrum still have to take the state tests. And the state tests, if they're affiliated with the Common Core, at one point or another, they're going to have to learn that. So, we'd have to look into the details. Maybe some kids with IEPs can escape it. But my understanding is that states pretty much have to test about 99% of their students, including kids. Just the entire student body has to take the Common Core tests. So, I don't think that many kids are going to be falling through the cracks.
So basically, what's wrong with having standards?
So it's a great question. I believe in high academic standards, but reasonable people disagree about how to define high academic standards. And so, I would like a Montessori play-based curriculum for my children in kindergarten. That's not the Common Core. The Common Core is really emphasis on early literacy. Now, my concern is, well, when you've got a democracy, I think parents and community members should have a say in how the local schools educate their kids, whether they're going to be Montessori or more early literacy. And so what political science has shown is that when parents do not have a voice in the local school's philosophy of education, they check out. If they can't participate on the meaningful decisions about standards, they participate less in the PTA, they don't run for school board, they don't volunteer for field trips. And then actually it goes outside of the school where they don't want to necessarily run for local office or volunteer or vote. It has all sorts of negative consequences on civic participation. So my concern is that the Common Core is this instruction itself leads to following rules. And also the sort of the sociological observation is that it alienates parents from the local schools and political life in general.
From what I have seen from parents in school districts, 99% of them aren't going to do anything anyway. The only ones who are going to run for the school board or are going to do that other stuff are, I don't want to use the word the fanatics, but the true believers. They're the ones who are going to go.
Yeah. So the question here is, do you want to distribute political authority throughout the entire country, or do you want to concentrate educational authority in Washington, D.C. and state capitals? And both options have advantages and disadvantages, right? That maybe the national level can make good decisions, and maybe the local level will make bad decisions. So I'm trying to be reasonable and acknowledge that there are two sides to this dispute. But my argument is that the federal government has made a series of bad bets on education. I think that the Obama administration made a huge mistake with the Race to the Top program that incentivized states to adopt the Common Core. The Common Core had no track record. The problems weren't apparent for many people until they started to be implemented. And, you know, the Common Core is corrupting, from my perspective, education and all sorts of other topics that are aligned with the Common Core. So for me, I would rather err in the opposite direction and trust parents and community members to run the schools than keep allocating educational authority to the Capitol.
Well, we already have evidence of that, though. We have Massachusetts and we have Mississippi. So that's pretty much what you're going to get.
Well, the question is, you know, people sometimes assume that when you have national standards, you'll have high standards. But, you know, I've never met anybody in the Common Core fight who's protesting because they think that education is too good for their children, right? I mean, in New York, we've had one-fifth of this of the families refuse the Common Core test. We've got a lot of angry people in New York, and they don't think that schools have become better. I mean, they think that they've become, no offense to Mississippi, but they're closer to a low-performing state education system than what we had previously.
I'm just thinking, I wish my parents would have opted me out of the Regents exams back in the day.
Did you take Regents?
Oh, yes, yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, well, they were, you know, the in the olden days, the New York's Regents exams required students to read a lot of books and make connections to things they had read outside of the test, the things that they had read the day of the test. So actually the Regents used to be a fairly competitive process, but now with the New York State Common Core test, there's this expectation that pretty much every student has to pass the tests to graduate. So it's no longer a prestigious thing. It's just a hurdle that kids have to cross to graduate.
Still to come, our conversation with Dr. Nicholas Tampio continues with his objections to standards that are not part of the Common Core. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Nicholas Tampio, an associate professor of political science at Fordham University in New York, and the author of the new book, Common Core, National Education Standards and the Threat to Democracy. In the book, you don't just talk smack about the Common Core. You also go after other standards that aren't part of the Common Core, the National Sexuality Education Standards, the Advanced Placement for U.S. History, which you call the de facto standard. So it's not just Common Core that you object to.
No, I mean, I'm a political scientist, a political theorist, and part of what I do in my book, Common Core, is make a argument about how education authority should be distributed in a democracy. And if the Constitution was to identify education as a federal power, it would have done this in Article 1, Section 8, but it is not mentioned in the Constitution. And according to the 10th Amendment, powers unenumerated in the Constitution belong to the states and the people. So for much of American history, education has really been a local matter with maybe just some data collection by state authorities. It's a little bit more complicated, but by and large, up till the middle of the 20th century, education has largely been a local thing. And for the past 50 years, we've seen this increase of federal power. And with this increase of federal power and increase of federal spending, we see more strings attached to federal funds. And so what we're at the cusp of right now, if we're not actually there, is that we are coming up with national education standards in literacy, numeracy, social studies, and science. And you can look on the horizon and you can make an argument that sex ed could also come along the way. And what I do in my book is I show that reasonable people disagree about how to teach all of these things. And my argument is that there are huge costs to nationalizing any vision of education. That what you're basically telling parents or scholars or citizens is that you have no voice in the schools, you have no voice in one of the key factors of politics. And so, you know, I think you're setting people up to be desperate or to become alienated from the political system.
Is it the standards that are objectionable or the way they were implemented?
I think the standards themselves are objectionable. And I should be clear, I don't necessarily think that all of America should have my vision of education. I would like to argue in my local schools for the principles of John Dewey. And John Dewey really thinks that you should do things with your hands. Well, there's none of that in the Common Core. There's no reference to experiential learning or doing field trips or doing hands-on activities. But what the Common Core does is it really emphasizes students learning the art of citing specific textual evidence. And my view is that this is really going to crush the spirit of creative, entrepreneurial kids. It's basically just rule following. It's drudge work. Lots of people on social media have been, you know, sharing stories about how much the Common Core boxes you into a certain way of thinking. And I agree with that assessment. So, you know, it's not so much that everything in the standards is wrong, which is clearly not a tenable position. But I do want to argue that people should have a say in how kids are educated. And that's not happening right now.
Would you say, though, that there is, you know, a finish line that every kid should get to?
Well, the problem is that that first off is that scholars and reasonable people disagree about what that finish line is. And then part of the other problem is that when you set the bar for all students and you're focusing on that particular bar, you're going to be having all sorts of negative consequences. I'll give you one example. The Common Core math progressions are really strict from kindergarten to eighth grade. And what that means is that kids who are really advanced in mathematics can't go beyond that very easily. So one of the things we're facing in Westchester, New York, is that to catch up for calculus, they have to do these what they call 3-2 programs, where they condense 3 years of high school math into 2 years so that students can move fast enough to reach calculus as a senior. But what the net effect is that fewer students in Westchester are going to be taking calculus. So that's part of my concern about the Common Core, is that it's one size fits all, and that it does, you know, that hurts students for whom the size doesn't fit.
But there will be some places in the country, and I'm not going to point out a specific region because they're all over the country, where there are neither scholars nor reasonable people who will be forced to make these choices.
Well, one of the things that I do in my book is that I really try to listen to people in Baltimore, in Chicago, in Philadelphia, who are saying, listen, we want local control. Right, that sometimes education reformers in Washington, D.C. or in Seattle, Washington, or, you know, billionaires boardrooms, and they say, you know, we've got these great ideas about how to educate all these other kids. And, you know, actually what you're seeing is that urban parents are saying, hey, listen, we want local control too. So I think the American political imaginary is still sort of stuck in 1950s, where the federal government had to come in and desegregate the Little Rock, Arkansas schools. That's not where we are in 2018. In 2018, communities and parents want to have a say in how to educate their children, and I think that they should have that right.
So what's the alternative? Where do we go from here?
My thinking is as twofold. One is that we need to remove the restrictions on local education authorities from having a meaningful say in how kids are educated. And so part of this will require us to revisit federal and state laws that specify what kind of standards are acceptable for communities. But really my positive vision is that I would like American education American educational system to be a landscape with many flowers. I think that we should have Waldorf schools and Montessori schools and progressive schools and traditional schools and Jesuit schools and French immersion schools, vocational programs, even good public schools with lots of different types of programs generated by the people who attend those schools. So that's my positive vision of democratic education in America.
Well, that sounds very good for Westchester, but in Checkerboard, Montana, that might be tough to have.
I don't think it's my responsibility to tell people in Montana how to educate their children. I think that parents in Montana should have a say in how their schools educate their children, and I think that parents in Westchester should have a say in how schools in Westchester run.
Again, the name of Dr. Nicholas Tampio's new book is Common Core, National Education Standards and the Threat to Democracy. It's published by Johns Hopkins University Press. So there are those who think the people who came up with Common Core created a monster. But that's nothing compared to the monster created 200 years ago by Mary Shelley, and that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Everyone knows the Frankenstein legend, right? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities, and today on the Academic Minute, Raymond Voisvert, professor of philosophy at Siena College, takes a deeper look.
Frankenstein, the very word stirs up images and issues. A square-headed creature, bolts in the neck, humans wanting to be gods, unintended consequences. Such images and issues result from the films of the 1930s, not from the original story written by 18-year-old Mary Shelley. The novel, published two centuries ago, March 11, 1818, is more talked about than read. The distortions started with stage adaptations. The first was called presumption, that is, a mere human presuming to take on a godlike role as creator. The 1931 movie, based on a later play, highlighted two things. The creature was given a defective brain, and the scientist, Frankenstein, uttered his famous line, "Now I know what it feels like to be God." Shelley's novel does not highlight presumption. It draws attention to the consequences of abandoning parental responsibilities. Victor Frankenstein, circumventing female involvement entirely, brings all by himself a new creature to life. The resultant being is immediately rejected by its father. Because it is ugly, the creature is also rejected, shunned, and attacked by everyone he meets. He is depicted by Shelley as the classic other, the ugly, different one, judged only by external appearance. The novel is, as widely assumed, a cautionary tale. But it's not about wanting to become like God. It's about taking fatherly responsibilities seriously. It's about judging others on character and not on looks. The story warns about what happens if someone is never lovingly hugged. The creature had neither biological birth nor motherly caresses. There was also another major absence, no fatherly tenderness. Victor Frankenstein's vice is not that he wants to become like God. His flaw is turning away from the responsibilities of fatherly affection.
That was Raymond Voisvert of Siena College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.